Thank you very much, Colm. And it's a great honour to be able to deliver the Warren Hogan lecture here today. As Colm mentioned, Warren was on the chair of the Economics Society here in New South Wales on a couple of occasions, and on at least one of those occasions, I was had a few years on the committee with Warren. So that was very much my interaction with him, as he was still very much keen on making sure that economics in New South Wales was thriving. I'd also, Colm said, I'm not a graduate of this university, coming from the esteemed University of Adelaide. However, Mick Plum, who is a graduate of this university, basically wrote the speech, so you can blame... Not quite true, but you can... I will take the credit and he can take all the responsibility for the errors. So, as Colm said, tonight I'm going to talk to you about uncertainty. There we go. And one thing I'm not uncertain about is what I'm actually going to say, so I've actually thought about this beforehand. So uncertainty, though, is one of the few certainties in monetary policy decision-making. It enters at nearly every stage of the process, from understanding where the economy is at the moment to knowing where it will be in the future. And tonight I will discuss some of the main ways that uncertainty affects things in terms of monetary policy. And in doing so, I'll also draw on the super forecasting template, which has been described by Philip Tetlock in the last little while, which I think is a very useful way to think about how uncertainty enters the monetary policy decision-making process. I will also discuss the monetary policy reaction function, which is one area where we, the Reserve Bank, can at least try to minimise the uncertainty. So you might be uncertain about where we are, you might be uncertain about where we're going, but hopefully you'll have some idea about what the hell we're going to do. So in describing these various manifestations of uncertainty, so that's what I'm going to be talking about, I will also outline some forthcoming changes to the way uncertainty is presented in the RBA's Statement on Monetary Policy. In particular, the changes we're going to make in the next Statement on Monetary Policy, which comes out in a couple of weeks' time. And the intention of these changes is to portray uncertainty in a form that is usable and understandable, I would hope. The other thing I'd like to do is, taking account of that uncertainty, is to discourage an excessive focus on false position. So whether we change things by a 0.1 or 0.2 here or there is not that great in the general scheme of things in terms of uncertainty. And so, as I said, I want to try and shift the discussion a little bit from where it often tends to land. What I first want to do is talk about uncertainty about the present. So it's obviously important to have a good idea of where you're going, in order to know where you're going. And we do have some sense of where the economy is, which is good, albeit imperfect. Most of the time, the uncertainty about where exactly we are is not consequential for the to the setting of policy, but at particular times it can be. So some of the uncertainty relates to the frequency of data releases and the time it takes for data to be collected and published. So if I take the case of output and inflation, which are two of the most important summary statistics on the economy, it's now late October. We're about to receive an airplane takeoff, it sounds like. We won't receive an official read on GDP in the current quarter, so where we are now, until the December quarter national accounts are released in early March of next year. So to understand where GDP is in the current quarter, which we're in the middle of now, we won't find out about that until early March of next year. So that's more than 4 months away. So, by the way, this is by no means intended as a criticism of the ABS. It just highlights the challenge, particularly given we're standing in the lecture theatre, it just highlights the challenges of compiling such statistics for an entity as large and complex as the Australian economy. So take the case of inflation, which is also published quarterly in Australia. We won't get an official read on the current rate of inflation in the current quarter until the December quarter CPI is released in late January, which is 3 months from now. Just like worth noting that in most other countries, the CPI is published monthly. So the wait to get an assessment on current inflation is not so long elsewhere as it is here. And so more timely and more frequent estimates of output, though, and inflation are not unambiguously desirable. I mean, we don't expect to get a net reading on GDP tomorrow. You know, we do, you know, And if we did, it probably wouldn't be very good. So there is a trade-off between timeliness and accuracy. In the case of inflation, though, a more frequent estimate would help to identify changes in the trend in inflation sooner. It will probably come with more noise, but we have ways to deal with that. Any reading of inflation always contains varying degrees of signal and noise about what the true inflation process is. But at the moment, we need to wait 3 months to get a better understanding as to whether any particular read we have on inflation is signalling a possible change in trend, or is it just noise? And that's one of the reasons why the RBA has long advocated the shift to monthly calculation of the CPI rather than the quarterly one we have had for a number of years. That said, we do not solely depend on GDP and the CPI to assess the current state of the economy. We spend a lot of time and effort piecing together information from a large number of other sources. So these include higher frequency and more timely data, including from the ABS, but also from a wide range of other data providers. The information we obtain from talking to people, particularly through our business liaison program, is also invaluable. The question then arises as to how we can filter the information we receive from all these different sources of information to gain an overall picture about inflation and the state of the overall economy. So let me take GDP as an example. So some of the data released before the national accounts, such as monthly retail sales and international trade, feed directly into the calculation of GDP. So we have a direct read on those parts of the national accounts. And we now cast other components of GDP using data that are more timely. So let me illustrate with household consumption what I mean by now casting. So we get a good measurement of consumptions of goods, so how much goods people are buying, by looking at monthly retail sales and sales of things like motor vehicles and fuel. But there is little timely information on household consumption of services, so the nowcast of this component relies much more on statistical relationships, previous historical relationships between consumption of services and other indicators such as consumer sentiment and the like. Some of those relationships are actually pretty weak, so we supplement this with information on sales from our regular discussions with our business liaison contacts. So that then gives us an estimate of consumption for the quarter. To get a preliminary nowcast for GDP growth for the quarter, we aggregate our best estimates for each of the relevant components, and there we have it. We can then ask ourselves whether this estimate is consistent with the other information that we have, such as the monthly labour market data, as well as predictions from our macro forecasting models. So we cross-validate the best estimate we get as to where the economy is now using a whole bunch of different data sources. And that nowcast can then be updated as new information comes to hand. That said, my observation from a couple of decades of forecasting is that your first estimate of GDP, some 3 months before it's published, is often the best, and any updates you do in between times are probably going to send you awry. But anyway, we do have the technology to take account of this new information as it comes at hand, and we can update our assessment of where we are as that information comes in. So aside from when the data is published, uncertainty about the present also arises from how things are measured. And this takes two forms. First, there is the methodology used to actually measure the variable in question. And second, there are the revisions to data after they were first published. So on the methodology point, a good example is the CPI. So the CPI measures prices for a large number of items purchased by households. When aggregating these to calculate the overall consumer price index, each item is assigned a weight based on the average share of household spending. So to come up with the CPI, say the household spends this much on telephones, spends this much on food, spends this much on housing, add them all up, and that gives me an overall CPI. So the aim is to weight each price by the amounts households actually spend on it, on average, in the period in question. Obviously, these weights change through time, but the weights used in the CPI are only updated each time the ABS conducts a household expenditure survey, actually goes out and asks households how much they are spending on various things. And in recent times, that's only been every 5 or 6 years. So in between each of those household expenditure surveys, a number of things can happen. First of all, some new goods and services come along that weren't there before. So one example you can think of is a mobile phone, though it's not quite that straightforward as, you know, for those of you particularly a bit younger than I am, before mobile phones came along, there were these things called phones. They were a little more stationary. They weren't quite so mobile, but they did exist. There were ways of communicating. to other people, which didn't. And households spent money on landline phone bills. Now they spend money on mobile phone bills. They also had these things called cameras, which weren't on their phones, and they spent money on cameras. So a lot of the services which are embodied in a mobile phone were available before. They just weren't. Now they're bundled up in one mobile phone. So often these new goods are providing similar services to something that was there before. Nevertheless, the ABS needs to take account of these new goods coming in, as well as some of the old items dropping out. Secondly, in addition to new goods and coming in and old goods going out, households adjust their spending in response to movements in prices and income. So in practice, and this is hopefully something you learn in your basic economics courses, households tend to substitute towards items that have become relatively less expensive and away from items that become relatively more expensive. So as prices go up, households tend to move away from consuming those sort of goods. But the expenditure weights in the CPI are only updated every 5 or 6 years. So households are changing their expenditure shares all the time, but the ABS only records them every 5 or 6 years. Over time, the effective expenditure weights in the CPI become much less representative of actual household expenditure patterns. That is, they're putting more weight on items whose prices are rising than households are actually spending on them. And this introduces a bias in the measured CPI, which is known as substitution bias. And that's only addressed every time the expenditure weights are updated. So the infrequent updating of weights that we have tends to overstate the measured CPI inflation. So the ABS will very shortly, in the next few days actually, update the expenditure weights in the CPI. Because of substitution bias, history suggests that the measured CPI has been overstated by an average of around a quarter of a percentage point in the period between expenditure share updates. So a quarter of a percentage point on average, which, while we're aware of that bias, we're not able to be precise about its magnitude until we actually get those new expenditure shares, because past reweightings are not necessarily a good guide to the future. So it's not very straightforward for us to take account for that in our forecast of inflation. That said, from a policy point, so this is one of the points I'm going to make a few times throughout this talk, is the question is whether or not this is actually consequential for policy. So you can identify that there's a substitution bias of a quarter of a percentage point, but does it actually really matter? And from a policy point of view, the way our inflation target is defined here is pretty much sufficiently flexible to accommodate that bias, given it's a relatively small size. Going forward, though, the ABS is going to update the expenditure shares annually rather than every 5 or 6 years, so that will reduce the substitution bias in the measured CPI. Possibly a more consequential form of uncertainty about where we are, and sometimes also where we've been, comes from revisions to data after they were first published. And I'll illustrate this point with a couple of recent examples. So what I'm showing you here is non-mining business investment, which is something which we've been paying a fair amount of attention to for the last few years. And the blue line is an earlier vintage of the data, and the red line is the current vintage of the data. So the revisions between these two things came out in the ABS's annual national accounts for 2015-16. And there was a sizable reappraisal of the allocation of total investment between the non-mining and mining sectors of the economy. There were upward revisions to the level of mining investment through the past decade, which were offset by downward revisions to the level of non-mining investment. So you can see non-mining investment's a lot lower than it was in previously published data. The other thing you can note is that the slope of the line recently is quite materially different. The previous vintage, it was flat, basically, for a number of years. The most recent vintage now has a decently large upswing. So why is that important? Well, for quite some time, we've been sitting there waiting, well, hoping, forecasting, a rise in non-mining business investment. And the previous vintage said that this had yet to occur. The current vintage says, yes, actually, there has been a decent rise in non-mining business investment for the last few years, admittedly off a lower base. But nevertheless, from a growth point of view, the growth in non-mining business investment on the most recent vintage of data looks a lot more apparent than the basically flat profile which was there before. And so that's fairly important from our assessment of what's happening, what are the trends going on in the economy at the moment. And that's a decently material shift between the two of them. So unlike the the bias in the CPI, which was probably not consequential for monetary policy. This is very much entering the in the realm of something which is actually consequential for policy, as it's changed, as I said, it's a fairly significant change to the profile in recent years. So as I said, that's very much welcome news from the economic outlook. As I said, a rebound in investment outside the mining sector has been a core part of the RBA's forecast for a while. So in this case, the revisions resulted in a reassessment both of where we are now, but also where we've come from. Another example concerns the household savings ratio, which is useful in gauging current and prospective developments in household consumption. And revisions there can also have a material effect on the household saving ratio. At times, over the last few years, there have been substantial in both revisions in both directions, which can change our understanding of what was going on at any particular point in time, and also complicates the estimation of historical relationships if the historical data change. So the annual national accounts, where the ABS confronts the data and takes account of possible inconsistencies, as well as incorporates new information sources, is actually due out tomorrow, I think, and might again change our understanding of where the economy is currently in some key areas. Hopefully this story survives, that would be nice, but we'll have to wait and see. Note again that this is not a criticism of the ABS. The process of collecting the data before publication is time-consuming and very challenging, both practically and conceptually, and the ABS does about as good a job as any statistical agency around. And the many of the issues I have raised here and more apply to data in other economies. All I'm trying to do here is just highlight some of the uncertainties that enter the assessment of where we are before we start worrying about where we might be going. In addition to these uncertainties about where we are, there are also uncertainties that arise from important economic concepts that we can't actually measure directly. One of these is the neutral policy rate, i.e. the rate setting a monetary policy which is neither stimulatory or contractionary. And I talked about that a little while back. Another is the degree of spare capacity in the labour market, which, like the neutral rate, is a fundamentally important concept to a central bank task with achieving price stability and full employment, but, like the neutral rate of policy, is difficult to measure spare capacity directly. So a useful benchmark for assessing the degree of spare capacity in the labour market and inflationary pressure is the NARU, or the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, basically the level of unemployment where we think below which there are likely to be upward pressure in terms of wages and prices. When the actual unemployment rate is above the NARU, there's spare capacity in the labour market, typically exerts downward pressure on wage growth and inflation. But the NARU isn't observable, but it can be estimated. And I've spent some years of my life doing just that. These aren't my estimates. These are the latest estimates of staff at the Reserve Bank. So we can only estimate this indirectly rather than directly measured like GDP or inflation. So what I'm showing you here is various vintages of NARU estimates. So the line which has got labelled 1991, it's a bit hard to see, but that uses data only up to 1991 to estimate the history of the NARU. And then we add one more year to 1992, and we can incorporate that information and update our estimates of the whole history, and so on up until 2017, which is using data up to the current period. So as we get a set of outcomes for inflation and unemployment every quarter or so that are different from what our previous model of the NARU suggested, we can apportion the difference to either the residual in the estimated equation, just say that's an error, or we can actually change our estimate of the NARU. So we say, okay, now we know that with this level of unemployment, we've had this sort of outcome in terms of wage or price inflation. And as I said, we can either say, well, that's just something which isn't explained by the model, or it means we actually have to update our estimate of the NARU. What this graph shows is that actually most of the time our current estimate of the NARU is not much different from earlier estimates. So as we got new data, it didn't actually change that much most of the time, but not all the time. So there are a few noteworthy divergences between different vintages of the NARU. Most of those occur around sharp movements in the unemployment rate. So somewhere around 1997 there, and also more recently around the time of the financial crisis where the unemployment rate spiked up. So, and that's when it's particularly difficult to disentangle how much of those movements are structural versus cyclical. So note, in these circumstances, though, the sign of the unemployment gap isn't changing, just the size of it. So we still know what the sign, you know, whether the unemployment gap's positive or negative, it's just the size of it. We become much more uncertain about it. So, as I said, this is one, it's an uncertain economic concept, but by and large, it doesn't seem to move all that much, which is nice. That said, another way of looking at it, though, is to take that model and say, what is our confidence interval around that estimate? So as you can see, the current estimate of the NAIRU we've got here in this graph is around 5%, and the 70% confidence interval around this estimate is plus or minus 1 percentage point. That is, we can be fairly sure that the NAIRU lies somewhere between 4 and 6%. Maybe that's not quite so helpful. But what does this uncertainty about the NAIRU mean from a monetary policy point of view? How big a deal is it that we can only say it's maybe somewhere between 4 and 6%? And, you know, particularly if we think about it at the moment, the unemployment rate's actually sitting below 6%. Is that a big deal? So the estimates, as I showed in the previous slide, suggest that the NAIRU is slow-moving most of the time. What that means is that changes in the actual unemployment rate generally give you a pretty good gauge as to what is going on in terms of the general direction and extent of change in spare capacity in the labour market. So we can have this estimate most of the time it doesn't move that much, which basically means a pretty useful shorthand is just look at what's happening with the unemployment rate. We can then see how outcomes in terms of wages and prices evolve in subsequent periods to assess whether we need to revise our estimates of spare capacity. But as I said, most of the time, we're not likely to revise those estimates materially. And that is why I think the unemployment, just looking at the unemployment rate itself, actually gives you a pretty good idea as to what's actually going on in terms of the current state of the economy. So at least from my point of view, that's probably about the most useful summary statistic as to what's going on in the sort of real economy side of things. We can bring other pieces of information to bear to confirm that assessment of the current state of spare capacity in the labour market, including information from business surveys. Measures of underemployment, particularly currently, are also helpful. And we also get a lot out of talking, as I mentioned earlier, through our business liaison program, and they give us a pretty good indication of whether wage and price pressures are starting to emerge in particular parts of the economy. That said, there are periods where this ability to rely on the gradual evolution of estimates of spare capacity breaks down. And the most obvious example of this was in the 1970s, where it looks like estimates of sort of the NAIRU jumped up quite significantly in a very short period of time. And if you just use the unemployment rate as a gauge, that was probably going to lead you astray and may or may not have, you know, probably did lead a number of central banks astray in terms of setting a monetary policy in the 70s. So we always need to be alert to these possible regime shifts. Most recently, this has also been an issue, unlike in the 70s, it's been a pleasant issue on the downside for a number of central banks. So if you look at what's happening in Germany or in the US or Japan at the moment, the unemployment rate is continuing to go down, but wage and price pressures still seem to be absent. So in the US, Germany and Japan, where the unemployment rate is today is below where their estimates of the NAIRU were a year ago. But they're still not seeing any increase in wage and price pressures. And so what they're doing is they're revising down their estimates of what the NAIRU is and saying, actually, there is still spare capacity in the labour market. I said, at least in this circumstance, unlike the 70s, it's a good development. Unemployment's coming in lower, wages and prices are still not rising, and I said that's a positive. However, this presumably can only go on for so long, as eventually the laws of supply and demand do mean that eventually you will run out of workers, or as new workers become increasingly hard to find, companies will actually have to pay higher wages to fill jobs. But at least in the US and in Germany and in Japan, they haven't got there yet, notwithstanding the fact that they would have thought they would have got there quite some time ago. Here in Australia, our assessment is there still remains a sizable degree of spare capacity in the labour market. Our current forecast is that spare capacity will be gradually reduced in the period ahead, but as it is reduced, we will be alert to the possibility that those sort of developments that we're seeing in the US, we're seeing in Germany, we're seeing in Japan, in terms of subdued inflation in the face of minimal spare capacity, we'll see, check, make sure whether or not they're occurring here too. So as I said, what I'm trying to convey here is that we have this uncertainty about where we are at the moment, including around both from a data point of view, but also from a conceptual point of view. Most of the time, that sort of uncertainty isn't all that material. I showed you one example where it changed in terms of the business investment profile, But most of the uncertainty, particularly around some of the concepts around the labour market, isn't so consequential for the setting of monetary policy. So having talked about uncertainty about the present and the past, I'd now like to turn to discuss uncertainty about the future. So I talked about this in a speech almost a decade ago, and as I said at the time, so I'm going to reference Jim Morrison again, who wasn't a graduate of Sydney University, but anyway. But he put it best which in saying that the future's uncertain and the end is always near. So the future is definitionally uncertain. Monetary policy affects the economy with a lag. That's one of the first things you get taught when you get taught about monetary policy. Changes in interest rates affect output, employment and inflation over a period of time. So in Australia, we estimate that a change in the policy rate today has its peak impact on demand in about 12 to 18 months. The peak impact on inflation is closer to 2 years. So in thinking about the appropriate stance of monetary policy today, we need to make an assessment about the likely state of the economy over the next couple of years. So we need to make forecasts. How much output is going to be produced in the economy in 18 months' time? How fast will prices be rising in 2 years' time? How will changing the level of interest rates today affect these outcomes? These questions are difficult to answer with any degree of precision. The inaccuracy of economic forecasts is well documented and often much maligned. So as Glenn Stevens, who is a graduate of this university, noted when speaking on forecasting a few years ago, one big difference in economics is that some decisions based on forecasts may alter the outcomes, as is the case of economic policy decisions or spending decisions by businesses and households. So we make a forecast, then we change the interest rate, that's changing the outcome. So our behaviour or our responses actually have an impact on the future. And that's one advantage that weather forecasters have over the economics profession. So human behaviour doesn't change the weather, at least over short horizons. Debate about over a long horizon. But when the Bureau of Meteorology came out and warned about thunderstorms today, it didn't obviously have a direct effect on the likelihood of those thunderstorms actually happening. Whereas if we say, as a result of our forecast for the economy, we're going to change interest rates today, that is going to have some impact on the likelihood of that forecast actually coming true. So economics has to deal with the vagaries of human behaviour, which seem to be much more difficult to predict and are generally more consequential than the vagaries of the weather, certainly over the horizon I'm talking about here. The economics profession has developed a range of methods to deal with forecast uncertainty. So rather than try and summarise that work, I'd like to discuss some of the ways we deal with forecast uncertainty at the RBA. Before I do that, I think it'd be useful to outline how the RBA staff generate forecasts for key variables like output growth, inflation, and unemployment rate. As I alluded to above, we begin with very careful analysis of the data, trying to understand where we are now. As I said, it's always useful to have some idea of where you are before working out where you're going. So we monitor thousands of variables related to the domestic and global economy and financial markets, and we try to understand the relationship between those variables. We also try and get a better understanding of developments in the economy by talking to people, firms, unions, employee groups, financial market participants, other public institutions and government departments, even academics, think tanks, and much of this occurs through the RBA's liaison program. We also talk to our colleagues at other central banks and participate in a range of international forums to try and understand global developments and how they might affect Australia. And the forecasts for key variables are then generated using a combination of econometric models and our judgment. And we try and take an eclectic approach to all of this. That is, for any given variable, we don't know what the true model is, or the true data generating process, if you want to think about it in terms of a more theoretical approach. There is rarely one single model that outperforms all the rest. Or even if we thought we knew what that one model to rule them all was today, structural changes in the economy mean that it mightn't be the true model tomorrow. So we typically estimate a range of different models for each of the key variables that we are interested in. So to some extent, you can think of this as akin to utilising the wisdom of crowds. So I'll try and illustrate that by considering the models we use to forecast inflation. So one approach is an extension of the Phillips curve that I was discussing a few minutes ago when we were talking about the Nehru, where inflation is a function of spare capacity in the labour market, import prices and inflation expectations. Another approach is to model inflation as a markup over input costs, such as growth in labour costs and import prices. We also use bottom-up approaches, for example, forecasting non-tradable and tradable inflation separately, and then aggregating those to get a forecast for overall inflation. We can also just use time series techniques to estimate the data generating process only using the inflation data itself. So we get a whole range of forecasts for inflation from those different methods. And one of the things that does is highlight the issue of model uncertainty. That is, we're not sure which model is the right model for inflation. And that poses the difficult challenge of how do we process and weight the different forecasts that we have. So we have this suite of forecasts, that's nice. How do we process them to come up with just one overall forecast? And that's where basically the art of forecasting comes in, though science can also help with this challenge too. Here it is important, in my view, to be flexible and eclectic rather than rigid and dogmatic. So rather than saying, okay, that's the one model, that's the one we're going to use, look at a range of models, each of which have some, hopefully, some information content, and use them to come to some overall view. In addition to single equation models, we also have a number of macroeconomic and multi-equation models that are used to cross-check the forecasts. And these models have the advantage of incorporating feedback effects. For example, higher wage growth increases firms' input costs, and that in turn leads to higher inflation. That in turn can then increase inflation expectations and encourage workers to start asking for higher wage growth. The macro models also have the advantage of imposing internal consistency, so we can have greater confidence that forecasts for individual variables are actually consistent with one another. Those models are also useful to check that adding up constraints aren't being violated. So I suppose one point to take from this is we don't have one single model. There is not an RBA model. There's a whole suite of information sources, a whole suite of different ways of forecasting these key variables that we need to take account of. And as I said, given the uncertainty about what is the true model, we need to be eclectic about the sort of range of inputs that we take into the forecasting process. Often we use our judgment to augment the forecast generated by the econometric models. And applying judgment is useful for a number of reasons. As I said, we don't have a fully articulated behavioural model of the economy. We're confident about the evolution of all parameters. So hence, we estimate models that are the average outcome over the time period over which they are estimated. That's what econometrics is, or what regression analysis delivers you. The model fits the data on average, but with some degree of imprecision. At any point in time, there are residuals. That is, at any point in time, the current outcome is not likely to be exactly where the model expects it to be. And that's where we can bring judgment to bear on those residuals and their possible evolution. There is likely to be information about the current state of the variable in question that is not easily incorporated in the model. For example, over the past decade, the information we've gained from our liaison program from talking to the large resource companies has been very informative and, most importantly, quite accurate about the profile of investment in the resource sector. So even if we could have a decent model of investment in the resource sector, the easiest way for us to go and generate our forecast for investment in the mining in the resource sector, we need to go out and talk to around about three companies, ask them what they were going to do over the next few years, add that up, and then lo and behold, that's what happened. That would be one of the more easy ways to go about forecasting. It helps if you've only got a few people you have to talk to, and they actually do what they say they're going to do. That helps too. But this information was actually difficult to incorporate directly into standard models of business investment. I said most of these projects were long-lived, took a number of years to execute, but we could actually get pretty good data on the spending that these companies were going to do quarter by quarter by just asking them. It was much easier to get a good assessment of what the investment in that sector was going to be by doing that rather than from trying to come up with an overall model of investment in the resource sector. So the nature of those idiosyncratic residuals or shocks may have some degree of predictability to them, which again we can utilise in the forecast. So we might look at the residuals today and say, okay, I've got a pretty good idea why that's happening and I have some idea that's going to persist for some period of time. That's not always the case, obviously. At other times, we also may have reason to believe that the econometric model has broken down. Behavioural parameters may change through time, particularly in the face of policy changes. Again, that partly depends on how well articulated your model is. So in the words of the standard investment disclaimer, past behaviour may not be a good guide to future performance. So we can have a really good model of past behaviour, but it's not always necessarily a good guide to future performance. Again, although judgment is necessary, though, we also have to be mindful of its danger. So it doesn't mean that we just impart judgment all the time willy-nilly. We also have to be disciplined in the way that we do that. So it can lead to biases, for instance, the tendency to see persistent patterns in random data. So we can see a set of residuals and say, oh, I know why that is, but actually all it basically is a random set of draws. It can also be harder to explain and replicate and refine than quantitative models. So we can make these judgmental adjustments. You can probably go some degree to explaining why you're doing that, but it's hard for someone else to replicate that. And it's also hard to then refine those judgments through time. So as elsewhere, a balance is needed. So we must always ask the question, how relevant is the past for forecasting the future? We have those models estimated, broadly speaking, on the past. How relevant are they going to be for the future? Or another way of putting it, does history repeat? Does history rhyme? Or is history just bunk? And that's the question we always have to be asking. So despite these efforts, the history of economic forecasting tells us that our central forecast will almost certainly be wrong. But there are things we can do to manage this uncertainty. And this is where I want to just refer to the methodology in Philip Tetlock's super forecasting, which is very helpful. So the way he portrays it is do your forecasting, fail, almost guaranteed, analyse why you fail, adjust, and then try again. We have no alternative but to do the forecasting. We can see how we go, work out why we went wrong, adjust, but then we have to do it again. So it is essential to ask after the fact, what did cause our forecast to be wrong? Evaluating forecasts ex post is as important as generating the forecasts themselves. And this can be described in three stages. First of all, where were we wrong? For which variables were our forecast misses the largest? Why were we wrong? There are a large number of possible reasons. Was it because the model was the wrong model? Has the model changed? Was our judgmental adjustment wrong? Was our forecast for an explanatory variable which fed into that model wrong? Was there an economic event or a shock that we didn't anticipate? And by the way, that shock has to occur outside the framework of the model. Having attempted to ask these questions, the third thing we can do then is ask, what can we learn from the answers to those questions? What, if anything, do we need to adjust in our forecasting framework? So to understand forecast misses, it's important to ask whether there are any unanticipated economic events or shocks. It's just as important to understand the source of these shocks. Not only can that help us understand the forecast misses, but it can also help us understand economic developments more generally. That said, it's important to be mindful of hindsight bias. So hindsight is always the best forecaster. So it's important to differentiate between what we should have known ex ante and what we can only have learned ex post. So let me illustrate this, the issue arising from forecast uncertainty, by showing you the forecast misses for underlying inflation and the unemployment rate since 1993. So this graph shows you the forecast misses for underlying inflation from a year earlier and unemployment from a year earlier. So you've got a combination of each of those for each point in time, and then they've plotted them on this quadrant graph, or actually, to be more precise, Peter Tulip plotted them. So he's the one who generated this. So not surprisingly, we have a decent number of forecast misses over this period of time, and forecast misses are more common than not, as I've already noted. The inflation misses, so on the vertical axis, are actually centred on zero. So they've been unbiased. Our forecasts for inflation over this period of time have actually been unbiased. We're just as likely to have forecast inflation a bit on the high side as we have been to forecast it on the low side. The unemployment misses, which are on the horizontal axis, as you can pretty clearly see from here, have actually been negative more often than positive. That is, on average over this period of time, the unemployment rate has been lower than we had forecast, which is actually a good outcome from the state of the economy, not so much from our forecasting point of view, but it's better to it that we made those errors than the opposite errors from the economy's point of view. But as a forecaster, this is obviously a bias we would hope to avoid. So on here, I've labelled some of the biggest forecast misses. Not surprisingly, a decently large number of them are in 2008, where we weren't the only people to make a few forecasting errors, misses in 2008. So that's obviously around the time of the financial crisis. What's interesting here, so this is the forecast in 2008, and what we're thinking is the economy is going to be a lot weaker than it turned out to be. And as a consequence, unemployment was going to be a lot higher than it turned out to be. So as I said, it turned out that actually that isn't what happened, which is, as I said, a good thing. So we thought, as we were in 2008, the things were in 2009 wasn't going to be good. Turned out it wasn't quite as bad as we thought. So if we ask ourselves, why did things turn out to be better than feared in this instance? Go through that explanation of saying, okay, we missed the forecast. Why was it? Why do we think that was so? A large part of the explanation was the unexpectedly large fiscal stimulus in China in 2008 and 2009, which was particularly beneficial for the Australian economy. There was also the beneficial effect of fiscal actions in Australia, and the labour market in Australia turned out to be more flexible than we had expected, so the unemployment rate didn't rise by as much. Finally, there was a domestic monetary policy response, and this is where I talk about the fact that we have an impact on the outcomes ourselves. So we had these forecasts, so what do? We lowered interest rates. Turns out that unemployment, as a consequence, didn't rise by as much as we expected, as we'd previously forecast. And also, the exchange rate depreciated. Both the extent of the monetary policy easing and the depreciation of the exchange rate, neither of them were forecast. So most of these fall into the category of ex post events, which were difficult to foresee ex ante. So the cluster at the top represents the increase in underlying inflation in 2008, which we also didn't fully anticipate. In the bottom left is 1999, where both unemployment and inflation turned out surprisingly well. But those outcomes are actually unusual. Most of the time, though, the errors are actually concentrated around the centre of the graph. And to reinforce that point, I've drawn those 70% and 90% ellipses, which shows, you know, that most of those errors actually incur somewhere fairly close to zero. And a feature of the chart, I think, which is interesting, is just how featureless it is. It's tempting to assume, so if you look, you're thinking about combinations of output and unemployment forecasts, you might actually tend to think that there'd be a much more of a pattern between those. So it's tempting to assume that they'd actually be negatively correlated. So if unemployment turns out to be too high, we'd expect inflation to be too low, and vice versa. What this graph shows is actually that isn't most of the time what happened. And that would be, so that in that world, that's consistent also with demand shock. So if there's a demand shock, a positive demand shock, unemployment's a bit low, then you would have otherwise forecast you'd expect inflation to be high. In reality, as you can see here, there isn't much correlation. There is no systematic correlation between inflation forecast misses and unemployment forecast misses. Supply shocks, basically, which would have unemployment and inflation miss in the same direction, have been about as common as demand shocks over this period. So having shown you what these forecast misses are, the question is, how consequential are these forecast errors for the actual setting of monetary policy? So to a large extent, that's the acid test. The answer to that question is dependent on whether the forecast misses were foreseeable ex ante or ex post. It also depends, as I said earlier, on what the monetary policy response actually was between when the forecast was made and when the outcome is actually realised. As I noted earlier, one challenging dynamic in forecasting this economy is that we're all actually participants in the process and can have an actual impact on the actual outcomes with our future actions. So we see these forecasts, we respond, we change the outcome, which basically ensures that we'll generate a forecast miss. So far, I've discussed how we think about forecast uncertainty and some of the approaches we use to make our forecasts as robust as possible. How do we actually go about communicating forecast uncertainty? So in the RBA's quarterly statement of monetary policy, our approach is to show graphically confidence intervals around the central forecast. So what I'll do here is show you, so this is from our last statement on monetary policy in August. And so I've got for GDP. So we've got GDP up until the second quarter of 2017, and then forecast beyond that. So the black line after middle of 2017 is our forecast for GDP over the next couple of years. And then I've shown you confidence intervals around that forecast. So the dark blue area is the 70% confidence interval around the central forecast based on our own forecasting error since 1993. So roughly speaking, and it's not completely statistically precise, but it's a useful way to think about it, it says that if we make similar forecast errors to those in the past, there is a 70% chance that GDP growth in 2 years' time will be between 2 and 4.5%. The light blue area is the 90% confidence interval. And what these intervals show is that there is considerable uncertainty around the forecast for GDP. This is true for other forecasters. As I said, this is based on our own, the RBA's forecasting errors. If I did it with other forecasters' errors, you get a similarish picture. And if you did it for the other economies, and you can see this, other central banks do this, you get a similar enough picture too. So in the Statement of Monetary Policy, we've also published a table of forecasts for key variables. And recently, these forecasts have been published as ranges. For example, we say our forecast a couple of years out is 2 to 3% for inflation. But what we're going to do in the next statement is these ranges are going to be replaced by just the central forecast of the nearest quarter point. Anything more precise than that is completely false precision in my point of view. So we're not going to say the forecast for inflation is 2.13%. We're just going to say it's 2.25%. So we're going to just provide you with a table of forecasts to the nearest quarter point, and we're going to provide you with these pictures, which we've been doing currently. So the evolution in the approach to trying to portraying the forecast and the uncertainty around them is because the technologies improve. We're making the changes because we can think we can provide more useful information about the central forecast and the degree of uncertainty around that forecast. And so what I would encourage you to do is actually focus on the central tendency which is conveyed by these pictures, rather than get obsessed about where exactly the central point is. So, because to some extent, what's consequential from the point of view is the direction of change of the central tendency, rather than exactly where that is to the nearest decimal point. So the industry of getting out a ruler and working out what exactly that point is not a particularly productive one, in my view. People do that, apparently. But what we're trying to convey is the general central tendency of our sense of where the economy is going. So try and avoid the trap of falling into the trap of false precision. What matters from a policy point of view is the general direction of change, rather than exactly whether it's gone up or down by a tenth of a percentage point. So the exact estimates in the end, I don't think are that important. The sense of central tendency conveyed by these sort of graphs is more important. And the accompanying text that we have in the Statement of Monetary Policy will help you will continue to provide our assessment as to whether these changes are consequential or not. The monetary policy reaction is more likely to be affected by where the actual outcome for inflation and growth fall within these intervals in the graph than whether or not the forecast in the table is achieved in the nearest tenth of a percent. As I said, similarly, focusing on how exactly the point estimates change from quarter to quarter is likely to be less informative than the evolution of the information in these sort of graphs. We'll also continue to supplement this information with discussion of some of the uncertainties around the forecast. And this gives some sense as to what are some of the forces that could cause the outcome to depart from the modal forecast. And that's one thing I think was important to convey, is that what we're portraying here is the modal forecast, the most likely outcome, not the average forecast. So that is what we don't do is, so we, these uncertainties that we talk about may be low probability events, but if they realised, they would be highly consequential for the Australian economy. The discussion of these different scenarios comes from asking ourselves the question, ex ante, what things could cause our central forecast or the central tendency of the forecast to be wrong? You know, what would our forecast look like, say, if the exchange rate was 10% lower than we assumed? What would it look like if Chinese GDP growth slowed sharply? Or if households saved less income than we assumed? So all of them are uncertainties we discussed in the latest statement. These scenarios involve changing a key assumption or central forecast for a particular variable and then evaluating the outcome relative to the central forecast. The scenario effectively picks out a different point in the distribution of possible forecast outcomes. So macro models are an effective tool for scenario analysis as well, And we have several macro models we can use depending on the scenario we actually want to evaluate. Over the period ahead, what we'll be trying to do is conveying the potential outcomes of such scenario analysis in the statement of monetary policy. So rather than just talking about them, we'll try and give you some idea of the quantitative impact of the size of them. So at various times throughout this speech, I've raised the issue of how consequential these various sources of uncertainty are for the monetary policy decision-making. So most of the time, uncertainty about where we are, not consequential. So we need to acknowledge them for what they are, but they have to be, we need to acknowledge these uncertainties, but to some extent we just have to live with them and have to be taken for what they are. So most of the time we can assume they'll probably evolve only slowly in a way that gives us time for monetary policy to respond appropriately as they are realised. And another way of putting that, as I said a minute ago, is that monetary policy responds to the modal forecast, the most likely outcome. If an uncertainty is realised that changes that modal outcome, then we respond appropriately when that information becomes available. It does not respond to the weighted average of the likelihood of all the various uncertainties. Amongst other reasons, that's because it's impossible to articulate all the uncertainties and or assign probabilities to them. So if you take a case in point, you know, nuclear war on the Korean Peninsula, got some sort of probability attached to it, outcome which might come from that, little difficult to forecast, particularly from economic point of view, probably not good, so at least you know the direction of change. But to be able to actually assign a quantity to both the probability of the outcome and its consequential effect, difficult. But if you were actually to take a very strict reading of what an average outcome would be, you'd have all these low probability but highly consequential events that you'd have to weigh up. And it's not entirely... Moreover, if you did respond to the average outcome, you'd unambiguously be wrong in your setting of monetary policy, with almost certainly. Whereas if you respond to the modal outcome, which is the most likely outcome, then if that's realised, then your policy settings are probably going to be appropriate. So I said, if you set policy in response to the mean rather than the modal forecast, we almost certainly have the wrong policy setting in whatever future state of the world is actually realised. And this approach is very much in keeping with Brainard's description of gradualism in policy making under uncertainty. Respond to the modal forecast as other stuff comes along. But if material events come along, then you obviously need to change in a more decisive manner. But as the uncertainties evolve only gradually, then policy making also evolves only gradually too. So as I said, at times there is a need for a decisive policy response, in particular large shocks away from the modal path. And a good recent example of that was 2008. There was a very large shock which took you away from the modal path, and there was a very large policy response in response to that. But those events tend to be the exception rather than the rule. Whatever the circumstances, though, it is important that there is a good understanding of what the monetary policy reaction is likely to be. That is, it is important that people have a good understanding of what we're going to be. They can have reasonable surety about how the central bank responds, given the outcomes for inflation, unemployment and output that actually come to pass. So you can be uncertain about what's actually going to happen, but once you see that's what's happening, then you have a good idea of how we, the central bank, are actually going to respond to that. That is, it's good that if you could have some confidence in saying, if I think this is my likely forecast for the economy, then it's likely that that monetary policy will be adjusted in this way. At the same time, it's important to note that the monetary policy decision is not rigidly and mechanically linked to forecasts, not least because of all the uncertainties I've just been discussing. So another way of putting this is that we can try and make the monetary policy decision-making process as robust as possible to the inherent uncertainty that we have no choice but to deal with. So let me finish up. Most, probably all decisions in life are taken under some degree of uncertainty, basically because a decision is about something that's going to happen in the future. Might be in the next second, but it's about something that's going to happen in the future. And the future's uncertain, as Jim Morrison said. Policy making under uncertainty is similarly a fact of life. As Philip Tetlock puts it, it is one thing to recognise the limits on predictability and quite another to dismiss all prediction as an exercise in futility. We have no choice but to predict. We have no choice but to forecast, as difficult as that may be and as uncertain as that may be. So in this speech, I've tried to articulate a number of ways in which uncertainty enters the monetary policy decision-making process. There's uncertainty about both where we are and there's uncertainty about where we're going. But not all of these sources of uncertainty are above the materiality threshold that impinges on the actual monetary policy decision or on other economic decision making. And so we need to avoid false precision in both our assessment of outcomes and forecasts and in our policy response to them. So just because an outcome has come in which is a tenth of a percentage point higher than what we might have forecast, that may not be probably isn't consequential for the monetary policy decision-making process. Comes in a couple of percentage points higher in terms of, say, growth or unemployment, probably is consequential for the monetary policy decision-making process. And so in that regard, what I've tried to say is noted the change to the way we'll present our forecasts to try and encourage a shift of focus on the central tendencies for the future PARs of key economic variables, because that's what I think are actually most consequential for the policy decision-making process. We will continue to assess how our forecasts turn out and adjust our framework and methodology where and when appropriate. We will try and understand the sources of our forecast misses and question whether they were knowable ex ante or ex post. And in doing so, we continue to aspire to have what Tetlock calls perpetual beta, that is, recognising the need to be cautious, pragmatic, self-reflective, analytical, and thoughtful updaters. So the beta, you always got to be continually questioning, evolving, updating. Don't be dogmatically stuck in a particular mindset. You've just got to, you know, as the facts change, you've got to be able to change your mind, as Keynes said. So as I said, that's the message I'm trying to leave you here with today. We have to deal with uncertainty. We have no choice but to do so. Whether the uncertainty is consequential or not, though, is to some extent what matters for the economic, for the policy-making, decision-making process. And most of the time, the uncertainty evolves in a way which is easy for monetary policy to manage. There are, however, on occasions, times when it doesn't evolve in that way, and that's when you're more likely to see a more rapid policy response. As I said, I'm trying to emphasise there is uncertainty around the process. One thing I hope there is an uncertainty about is whatever the outcomes are, what the monetary policy reaction will be to those outcomes. And with that, let me finish there. Thanks.
Thank you, Guy. Thanks so much. So one of the, in keeping with the theme, one of the things my iPhone tells me, which I wasn't able to do a few years ago, was predict the weather. And so in the, it seems like we have sort of Stormageddon heading our way in the next kind of 15, 20 minutes. So I think maybe we'll take maybe 10 minutes or so of questions, if that's okay. And while we had kind of planned to bring you down, we'll, it's a bit of a steep lecture theatre, so we'll bring a mic to you. So we have a question here, and then we have Marty here at the front. So one, two, and then a third behind.
Hi, Soren Pather, economics, Sydney University economics graduate, 1987. Very significant time in the world with one of the biggest stock market falls. Thank you for your great lecture on forecasting uncertainty. But I'd like to ask a practical question relating to 2007-2008. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a global financial crisis caused by excessive debt. Government stepped in to save banks, and then they couldn't handle it, and central banks stepped in to save governments. And all we saw happen was quantitative easing, to the point where from 2008 to 2017, total quantum of debt increased by $58 trillion, let alone derivative debt that's unquantifiable. And all we've seen that's happened right now is a huge disjoint in the world between rich and poor, to the point where we're seeing asset bubbles in both the stock market and property markets, and therefore leading to political instability due to this big disjoint. The question I want to ask is, you know, given this total amount of debt, yes, it appears everything is fine. Unemployment seems to be great. Why wouldn't it be with the monetary expansion? Inflation seems to be under control because it seems, again, that no one's spending any money because they're worried about their employment. So the question is there a day of reckoning? Is there a doomsday to come? Or am I just imagining this? We just keep on expanding debt. Now, in business, I understand no problem with expanding debt, provided at some point income is increasing faster than the rate of debt.
Yeah. I suppose I wouldn't quite ascribe to all those degrees of causation you said on the way through, but one point to note, as you said, unemployment is low, and it's nice you attribute that to monetary policy. But one thing I think is important to note is that absent the policy, so the question is, I suppose the way I would frame it is, so the alternative. The alternative is you don't have a policy response, and then I'd be fairly confident that you would have a hell of a lot worse outcomes in terms of unemployment, and that's a hell of a lot more damaging to income distribution than what we're seeing subsequently. So the first order impact on inequality, on income distribution, is whether or not people have a job. That has a much more material impact on that than almost anything else. And so the fact that unemployment in a lot of the major economies is, as I was saying earlier, about as low as it's been for a few decades, is something which is going the opposite, is something which has a first-order effect on income distribution. Yes, some of the other things you're talking about go in the opposite direction, that's absolutely true. But one thing which has a first-order impact is whether or not people actually have a job or not. I mean, I think, you can debate about the efficacy of the various policy actions, and that's a debate which is certainly worth having, and has been going on for quite some time. But in the end, I think if you look at where things are today, in most of the major developed economies, as I said, they've got unemployment rates as about as low as they've been for a long time. That's not a bad outcome, and you can debate the issues around inequality. I don't think I'd completely attribute them all to the policy response in 07 or 08. There are a few other things going on as well, both in terms of, say, technology and technological change and the differential impact that's been having. So I think that's a much more nuanced question. But, as I said, I do think, you can debate the degrees about the policy response, but in the end, some of the proof of the pudding's been in the eating, and there have been decent macroeconomic outcomes in a number of economies. And the counterfactual, I think, is unambiguously a lot worse than what we've actually seen. Yeah. Sorry, I can hear you. Others might not.
So one of the things you said, Guy, was that it'd be nice to have monthly inflation figures, as many countries around the world do. As we move forward into the era of the Internet of Things and increasingly big data, I'd be interested to know whether our problem may be that we have too much data and we don't have good tools for analysing it.
Yeah.
So I'd be really interested to hear your view, or the central banking view at the moment, on how you think this might be incorporated usefully. And I accept that academics like myself still have a lot of work to do in working out the tools that might make these useful. But what is the central banking view on whether you think this is going to be useful information for you?
So I think, and I sort of alluded it to, I mean, there's a trade-off between signal and noise, right? So more and more timely data is not always and everywhere unambiguously good. So there is that trade-off. As you say, you can have more information, but it's not much good if you can't actually process it, for one. That said, I don't think we're quite in the right point of that trade-off where we are currently with the information we have. So I do think we can shift to a better point by, for instance, utilising monthly CPI, and it partly comes back to something I said before. So we don't just want better information just because we can have it. There's a question of, is it actually material for our decision-making, I think is another way of looking at it. Because, being economists, we're well aware of the universality of budget constraints. The ABS, like everyone else, is operating under a budget constraint, and they've got to make trade-offs. And so you've got to work out what is the usefulness of the information which could be obtained versus the cost of obtaining it. Now, as you alluded to, so we're both seeing an increase in the volume of data, but we're also seeing an increase, there's a technological race in terms of the tools to be able to process that data. That's always been, to some extent, always been thus. I would say that we look at a hell of a lot more series now than we would have even two decades ago, partly because we can. So both they exist, but also we've got a greater capacity to process them, to try and extract that signal. You know, and we're operating under a budget constraint. We've got so many analysts we can throw at analysing the economy. What's the most useful way of analysing the data that we have? There's any amount of data that's out there. We could be out there collecting all the data from all the scanners at the supermarkets. Is that actually useful? The answer may well be yes, because now we may well have the tools to be able to process that in a way that just absolutely wasn't true a few decades ago. So I do, you know, I suppose I would frame it in that way, that we're operating under this budget constraint, but with a objective function, which is what is the usefulness we can extract from this in terms of the signal, or is it just going to give us, you know, it's the signal noise ratio too low in this respect, that we're really just mostly getting noise and not a hell of a lot of signal. I suppose the point I was making is, at least on the CPI, I don't think we're quite at the right point of that trade-off where we are currently. Mr. Fabo.
Justin Fabo from Macquarie. I got a guy. My question is about inflation, and I think, you know, you talked about a tenth of a point's not mattering here or there, and that's definitely true. But on average, you said, with the reweighting, I've got to talk about methodology, I love it. The reweighting of the CPI in the past, you know, looking like about a quarter of a point in terms of overstatement between the HESs. If also you think that maybe, you know, these global things that we haven't got a good feel for in terms of downward pressure on inflation, you know, are we picking up Amazon, are we picking up things like that in our inflation measures? Probably not. So maybe even inflation was even lower than that quarter of a point possibly over the last 5 years. So when we troughed, I think, at something like 1.5 for underlying inflation, we're now a bit below 2. Do you think now that actually matters more? You know, your predecessors and you have talked about getting a feel for the starting point of the economy, for the outlook for monetary policy, just how hard that is. If the starting point for inflation in recent years has actually been, say, a quarter to half a point below what it's actually been printed at, you know, how important is that? And do you think that could explain why wages growth around the world has looked lower, is actually in real terms maybe not so bad? And I want to give you the opportunity to talk about the currency. Is jawboning still off the table for the RBA? Does it work? Does it not? There's a bit of momentum behind the currency at the moment. So
which way, up or down?
Have a crack.
Yesterday it was down. The inflation point's sort of I certainly don't think a quarter point here or there is consequential for wage outcomes. That's, I don't think that everyone says, oh, it's, you know, oh, so what is it? Damn, the inflation rate's a quarter point lower than I thought. I'm going to ask for a quarter point lower wages than I thought I was going to ask for. I don't think is consequential for decision making. So it's below the decision making threshold. I think one thing which is interesting is, as I said, we have all these models, including the Phillips curve, which I stuck up there earlier, which links inflation to concepts of spare capacity, right? And that's based on a historical data, which has those biases in the CPI in there throughout the whole series. So you have to think about what that implies for your estimation. So just saying that it's lower isn't quite true, because also what it's doing is changing the nature of the... It has an impact on the relationship you've estimated in trying to work out where you are at the moment. I think one... In terms of, you know, there are, you know, it's a big global central banking industry at the moment trying to work out why wages and inflation are lower than you might expect them to be. Here, actually, it's not quite so much of a puzzle in the sense we are sitting here with what we think is spare capacity. So that does at least line up with inflation a bit on the low side and wages a bit on the low side. We're not like the US where... You know, your whatever you thought spare capacity was before, you're now below that, but you've still got low wages and inflation. So the dynamic here in Australia is different from what it is elsewhere. On Amazon, I think it's quite interesting that it'd have to be about the most effective advertising campaign in the history of advertising campaigns. Don't spend a dollar, get everyone else to talk about you, all your competitors to talk about you, before you're even here in the country. Pretty effective advertising campaign. Get them to adjust their prices before you even get here. Non-advertising campaign, I suppose. But But there are all these dynamics going on out there. I think one thing which is interesting is looking at what, as I said, this is a global phenomenon, not a local phenomenon, and therefore mostly requires a global... Well, the question is, does it require a global explanation, or is it just a whole bunch of idiosyncratic local explanations? I mean, there probably is something global going on out there. The fact that it is so ubiquitous across, certainly across the developed world, and even the developed emerging world too, actually. But it, you know, to some extent, as I said, coming to Marty's point about where resources are being devoted, that is one area where a hell of a lot of resources are being devoted to right around the world. But to date, haven't come up with a particularly good explanation yet.
There's two more questions here, and then.
David Taylor, ABC Radio. I'm just wondering, if we haven't seen what we want to see at the moment in terms of inflation and wages, is it possible that we won't get the pickup in inflation and wages for years to come? Have you got any evidence to suggest that that won't happen? I mean, are we going to get a lift in wages next year, the year after? When is it actually going to happen?
Well, on a minimum wage, you got a wage increase bigger than you were expecting last month. So for some people, it is happening, but not economy-wide, as you said. Similarly on inflation, I suppose the other thing... So as Justin mentioned a minute ago, inflation's higher than it was a year ago, not by a lot, but it has actually gone up, not down. And it's sitting just below 2 as the number we got it... got yesterday. We're going to publish a new set of forecasts in 2 weeks. Yeah. But at least judging on the ones we had previously, yeah, we expect it still to go up. It's pretty gradual, both on the wage front and on the price front. But, you know...
Can you understand the frustration, though? Because there's a big proportion of the Australian community that hasn't had a decent pay rise, but we're getting that evidence.
Yeah.
And it's becoming more and more frustrating for people.
Yeah. Well, as the Governor has said on a number of occasions, that is frustrating. And, but it is what it is. And, you know, from our point of view, it would be good if wages growth was higher, obviously for the people who are getting those wages would be good if their wages were higher. But and partly, as I was saying a minute ago, understanding why exactly that is the case is somewhat of a mystery. It's not something which is unique to Australia. It's a global phenomenon that we're seeing this unexpectedly low wage and price outcomes. The only thing I'd mention on the price side, so it's lower, but as I said, it's only just below 2. In the US, it's not quite where they want it. It's about 0.25% lower. So we're not talking... on the inflation front at least, really big misses. But on wages, it has been surprisingly low, and globally, not just locally. And it is a mystery, as you say. It is frustrating. It would be nice if it was higher.
And last question.
Thank you, Dr. Dobell. David Rome here. You gave quite an eloquent speech on all the approaches and the methodologies and the I guess you call it the complexities of modelling, macro aggregates and key variables the Reserve Bank undertakes, right? And the inherent uncertainty in it. And it was quite, I found it quite illuminating. However, what you didn't mention was from the practical point of view of us economists and retired economists and lay people and consumers, that we're confronted with not just the Reserve Bank, but we're confronted with the Commonwealth Treasury, who undertake rigorous macroeconomic modelling. We're confronted with numerous Commonwealth departments that undertake macroeconomic modelling. We're confronted with numerous state governments that do their own macroeconomic modelling. And surprise, surprise, we're also confronted with numerous private sector agencies and institutions that undertake macroeconometric modelling.
Yeah.
So in the jungle of econometric modelling, who is the King Kong, who beats the chest the loudest? Do we, from a consumer's point of view, us in the community, do we have more confidence in the Reserve Bank's more sophisticated approach, or do we have more confidence in the Commonwealth Treasury's alleged sophisticated approach? Or even our colleagues in the university, when they come out, I'm sure you're aware of that Sydney the Sydney Morning Herald once a year, outline of, we'll pick 25 economists or groups and we'll see how all those forecasts narrowed out. So my simple question to that rather long comment was, the uncertainty also is just as important to us in the community.
Sure.
Because who the hell do we trust? The politicians will always choose the forecast they want to push, that they want to justify. But from the community's point of view, who do you trust in terms of, or what degree of confidence do we have, whether it's the Reserve Bank or whether it's our colleagues in Treasuries right across the board, whatever.
Yeah, sure. I mean, one thing I would say is that our forecasts and the Commonwealth Treasury forecasts are very similar. So there's, you know, if choosing one or other of those, not, you know, pretty much going to get the same same information there. But I mean, one thing, and you know, referred to Tetlock earlier, and so one thing, you know, it is useful that we just don't, it's useful that there is a bit of competition in the forecasting space, right? So that it's actually, you can learn from what other people are saying and you can discount it if you want. So I take your frustration from the public consumption point of view, but from at least our point of view, it's actually useful that there's a few others out there who are doing this and we're not just, you know, because that at least challenges us to justify why our why we have these forecasts and someone else has those forecasts. So that's a useful discipline to be able to have. You know, we obviously think our forecasts are okay, otherwise we wouldn't put them out there. So if you want to use them, go right ahead. I mean, they're our best guess as to what we think is going to happen. But as I said, and partly to that point, there's not, most of the time, there's not a huge variation. And to some extent, if you do see, you know, it makes for makes for good media to highlight the differences rather than similarities, right? But if you do see big variation, then that to some extent is interesting in and of itself, because that probably means that there is something probably pretty big going on there if you're able to get that big a range of outcomes. So to some extent, there is information in the distribution or the spread of forecasts that you actually see. But I would say, notwithstanding all of the different sources of forecasts that you said, by and large, the variation is not all that much. And, you know, it's challenging, but to some extent you're actually sourcing the wisdom of crowds by just looking at the range there and saying, OK, this gives me some idea of the spectrum. Most of the time that spectrum's actually not that large. And again, coming back to something I said earlier, probably not that consequential for your own decision-making. When that spectrum is large, I think that's interesting in and of itself, because as I said, that probably means something's going on and we may well be at some sort of large turning point in terms of the outcome. So actually, I think it's better to have that multiplicity of forecasts rather than just have one, because I think there's actually information in that variation which is useful.
All that's left for me to say is, Guy Duvall, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Cheers.